Hi, everyone. Welcome to Beyond Megafauna, Small Species, Big Loss. My name is John Platt. I'm the editor of The Revelator, and a lot of you probably know me from writing Extinction Countdown for many years. That's previously at Scientific American, now at the new site. So, you know, there's a trend in journalism to write a lot about wolves and bears and pandas and more wolves and, you know, but there's a lot of other things out there. You got your fish, you got your insects, you got birds, you got plants. A lot of diversity to talk about and a lot of reasons to talk about these things. And here to talk about those reasons and everything else, we have a great panel for you here today. To my right, we've got Jason Biddle, which is a fantastic wildlife journalist who covers some of the weirdest and coolest stuff out there. Next to him, we have Tierra Curry, a biologist at the Center for Biological Diversity, who covers some of the coolest and wildest creatures out there. And next to her, we have Justin Wheeler, the web and communication specialist for the Xerzy Society for Invertebrate Conservation. If you like bugs, this is an organization you need to have in your Rolodex. So we're going to let the panelists introduce themselves briefly and give a little spiel, a little talk about why they think this stuff is important. And we'll start with Justin.
Sure. So I work with the Xerzy Society. We're an invertebrate conservation organization. And I think what makes us unique is that we are science-based. So we do a number of things, including actually creating and protecting habitat on the ground, finding new ways to protect invertebrates, but also doing the surveying and scientific analysis to assess species and get them listed as endangered. The species that we work on, the joke is that we work on creatures small and smaller. So we don't, the closest we get to megafauna would be the monarch butterfly and bumblebees, and that's really more mega in terms of their notoriety than their size. So we work on a lot of very small and very obscure creatures that are very important to our environment and to our world.
So I'm Tierra Curry. I'm a biologist at the Center for Biological Diversity. And for the past 13 years, I've worked to save little uncharismatic microfauna that most people don't care about. And I have been losing these battles for 13 years now. John said that we should just put some padding in my office so that when I keep beating my head against the wall, I can keep going. I really love freshwater mussels and snails and animals. They're fascinating. They're underappreciated. They're super important. Come find me in the hallway, and I can tell you millions of reasons why these things are the things that make the world go round and why we won't be here if we don't protect them. But even in my own family, my nephew's like, T.T., why don't you work on polar bears? And the first time I was contacted by Congress about some species I was working on in the coal fields of Appalachia, I told my sisters, I called them up, I was so proud. I was like, hey, I just talked to these congressional staffers. And they said, you didn't tell them about freshwater mussels, did you? And then when I started working with the monarch, but on the monarch butterfly with Xerzes, they were so relieved that I was finally working on something pretty. And so I've petitioned for about 100 snails over the last 10 years at the center. None of them have gained protection. And it's not because they're not endangered. It's really an uphill battle. We do these endangered species murals around the country. We paint these beautiful, brightly colored murals in communities that have endangered species living near them so that people will be aware of the species. And even in that project, there's a hierarchy. Like the flying squirrels and the grizzly bears are so popular. And the freshwater mussel mural in Knoxville, which is like 300 feet long and 30 feet tall, it's amazing. It depicts the whole incredible life cycle. People are like, okay. And it's the coolest mural in the whole project. When you petition a species to the Fish and Wildlife Service to get it added to the endangered species list, they're supposed to make a 90-day finding and a 12-month finding. Back in 2008, I petitioned for some old-growth dependent snails and slugs in the Pacific Northwest. They still don't have their 12-month finding 9 years later. And the only species so far that has gotten a timely finding was the Miami blue butterfly, because butterflies tend to be more popular than other things, and it was declared extinct twice before it finally got protected. These little guys go extinct and nobody notices, and there's no sense of urgency to save them. Last year, the Steffens riffle beetle from Arizona and the Tatum cave beetle from Kentucky were declared extinct because we had petitioned for them, so the Fish and Wildlife Service had to go out and look for them. They went out and looked for them for the first time in decades. They were extinct. They put out their 12-month finding, like 40 years later in this case, and said, oh, they're extinct. And that was that, and we put out a press release, and you probably covered it before you came to work for us. Now I know the other microfauna journalist in America. And so we really have to do a lot more outreach. There's a great big education gap. We have this little campaign called Save the Weirdos, because I think even the ugliest and most uncharismatic microfauna, they have like a Garbage Pail Kids appeal to them. Like even the weirdest, ugliest ones, there's something really cool that we could do with them. So
I read recently that there are more freshwater mussel species in the U.S. than anywhere else. Yes. There you go. So my name is Jason Biddle, and it's true, I do like writing about these weird little guys, and I'm actually going to pivot from what I intended to talk about, just because I think a lot of people here are looking for their niche as writers and looking for things to report on. And if you're going to be a freelance writer and make money and, you know, have a career and have things to write about, several things to write about every week, like John and I have made a living on, that means looking for stories that haven't been told, and that means looking for stories that have little stories embedded within them. And a lot of times these little creatures, you know, you might be able to get a couple paragraphs about how neat they are or how pretty they are, but what you might get the rest of your story about is the, you know, the people working to save these things. And a lot of times the people story is what people, the readers, actually, you know, get into, because frankly, it's just kind of interesting that people like Tierra have spent, you know, their lives trying to save, you know, a slug in the Northwest that you've never heard of and will never see, and apparently is not, you know, very likely to be protected. So there's a lot that you can do with these stories. I feel like you shouldn't be hemmed in by, you know, it not being a big charismatic wolf or panda. And I think the other interesting part about these stories is it can actually be a way to get people involved in day-to-day conservation, because most people don't have a grizzly bear in their backyard, but they might be able to plant a milkweed plant and have monarchs, you know, complete part of their however many thousand-mile migration in their backyard. And that's pretty cool. And that opportunity doesn't exist with a lot of these species that have a gigantic ranges or very specific range restrictions. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of different ways to get into these stories, and I guess that's what we'll spend most of our time talking about here today.
Cool. So this is an incredibly broad question, because we have such an incredible diversity of species we're talking about. But what are some of the threats that these species are facing, and why should we be talking about how it impacts these little creatures that people don't see very often?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, in terms of the animals that we work on, invertebrates, you know, you'll often hear them referred to as keystone species, or, you know, bioindicators or things like this, where they're essential to the upper order, you know, megafauna that people do care about. And I think, you know, a lot of times we have to tie back the story to how it affects humans. And we have to view things through this human-centric lens, which I get it. It's, you know, it's how you get people interested in these species. But what's unfortunate is a lot of these creatures are really interesting in their own right. And I think, you know, the challenge is getting people to care about freshwater mussels. You know, every article you read about freshwater mussels starts with, there are these things that look like rocks and you're never going to see them, and they don't have eyes, and they have 1 foot. And that's great, and that's a great intro, and sure, that's a great way to get people into a story, but it doesn't tell the whole story about how incredibly valuable they are to the ecosystem. And I think if you look at a lot of these really obscure creatures, like one of my favorites is the Western Glacier Stonefly. This is a fly, so first of all, people don't like flies. It's not very interesting on the face of it. It lives in these two very small, isolated streams in Glacier National Park in Montana. And the reason that it's threatened is because the streams that it depends on are disappearing, because the glaciers that make Glacier National Park, are disappearing. So, you know, so if you look at this stonefly that generally people don't really care about, it's telling a larger story about climate change, about the environment, and about the way that our world is changing. So I think anytime you look at these invertebrates and these species, they tie into these larger issues of food security and climate and all kinds of other aspects of how we use our world.
I think that for the next 3 years, the single biggest threat to uncharismatic microfauna and other endangered species is the Trump administration. Just this week, Trump undermined Endangered Species Act protection for 69 endangered species. And I've had a really hard emotional week, honestly, because I've been working on these guys for a decade, and he just issued negative findings for them this week and then secretly pulled critical habitats this spring, and we just found out about it this week that Obama had proposed in his effort to undo everything Obama had done. So, like, in Las Vegas, there's these spring snails. Vegas wants to build a huge water pipeline that's going to dry up springs. So we petitioned for the endemic spring snails in the springs back in 2009. The negative finding doesn't even mention that pipeline. Most of the species have a climate threat, and they looked out about 20 years and said they'll still be there in 20 years. The Florida Keys moleskink is going to, as the sea level rises in the Florida Keys, the moleskink's going to lose all its habitat because it lives on the shoreline. They said, okay, the seas are rising in 50 years, it's going to lose half its habitat, but we don't know what's going to happen after 50 years from now, so it doesn't warrant protection. And there's been 47 attacks on the Endangered Species Act just this year. The Republicans in Congress are trying to gut the act entirely in numerous ways. And so a lot of my work now is just defending the Endangered Species Act itself, on top of habitat loss, climate change, oil and gas development, invasive species, pollution.
Yeah, I think the other interesting thing about a lot of these species is, whenever they're restricted to a very small range, virtually everything is standing against them. So there's, in the Mojave Desert, there's a little fish called the Devil's Hole pupfish, and it lives in this, 500-foot deep aquifer that's just, it's smaller. The opening of this is maybe the size of this table. You've been there. And there are less than 100 of these fish. They're less than an inch long. You wouldn't recognize them in an aquarium. There's really, no popular interest reason to save this fish. But they've been there for 50,000 years since the last ice age. And right now they're being threatened by climate change because their pool is already at, 93, 94 degrees, which is the very upper level of what a fish can sustain already. And it's getting warmer. And not only that, but because it's such a small base and it's linked to all this bedrock, it literally every time there's an earthquake in Mexico, all the water sloshes in this pool like a bathtub, and they only live on this one little shelf at the very top of the bathtub, and so everything gets churned up, and I mean the odds are not good. There's a 33% chance that they won't be around in 20 years. So why even spend money? We have like a $4.3 million center out there trying to raise these guys in captivity to save this species. 100 fish left. Well, the protections that protect the Devil's Hole pupfish also protect water all over the Southwest. So if you take away the protections for this, 100 fish in this hole in the middle of the desert that nobody ever sees, even if you go there, there's barbed wire fence around the top. You can't go down and see these fish. It actually might impact species all across the Southwest, and water rights. So there are all these issues that are tied up with all of these creatures, and it's rarely about one slug or one fish. So looking for the way that these stories branch out is important as well.
And that leads to my next question. What are some of the reasons why we want to preserve these things? Obviously, they're unique, and for that, they have their own reason for being there. That's one reason to protect them. They protect water. They're part of the ecosystem. What are some of the reasons we can use to talk about why these things belong on our planet?
Sure. Well, I think, probably the most famous species that we work on, again, are monarchs and bumblebees. And we just had a huge win in that the rusty patch bumblebee was the first bumblebee or the first bee in the continental United States to be listed as endangered. And so for us, I hate to use the term lucky, but we're lucky that some of the species we work on are pollinators. And there are things that have a very direct, very obvious link to humans and to, as I said, food security and agriculture and things like that. But if you look at the monarch on the face of it, and you ask a lot of people, do you care about the monarch? Almost everybody's going to say yes. And, should it need saving? Yes. But if you really ask them why, a lot of people would be hard-pressed to give you an answer. They might say something about it being, part of the food chain and this, that, and the other. But really, what we're seeing with the monarch, and you will see this with any species that we work on, is it's an indicator of a larger thing. So if the monarch goes, we know that it goes for a reason. It goes due to loss of milkweed, loss of habitat, environmental factors. And so I think you're going to find that with anything we work on. It's just really harder when those species aren't as big and pretty and in your face and directly tied into commerce and all of these other things. But almost any species that we, you know, we consider worthy of protection has some greater role that it's playing. And I think that's evidenced even in snails and in pupfish. So.
Yeah, declines in snails are linked in declines in songbirds because songbirds get their calcium from eating snail shells. Almost everything plays a role, even if we don't understand that role. And I would argue that a lot of these species were here before us. Modern humans have been here about, you know, 250,000 years, and we've changed everything. And we're erasing the future and erasing what's going to happen maybe even after us. We're erasing the whole direction the planet is going to go in terms of the raw materials that are still here. And we might not understand what every species does, but everything is doing something.
I wrote a story this week for onearth.org about crayfish, which are very underappreciated creatures. And we are moving them all over the world, and because we have this idea that one crayfish is basically as good as another crayfish. So when there was a crayfish plague in Europe, eventually we brought over, they brought over our crayfish to replace them because they like to eat crayfish. Well, it turns out our crayfish can carry a plague, but they don't die from it, so they were actually spreading the plague. They outcompete the native species because they're bigger, they're burrowers, they collapse streams, all these things that we just didn't think about. And we've learned a lot about the signal crayfish, which is the major invasive crayfish in Europe, because it's invasive. And once we got it there, we're like, oh, crap, we need to figure out how it's affecting everything. And they found studies, you know, very similarly that whenever you have signals come into a watershed, they can literally change the impact of, you know, the makeup of the biodiversity in that watershed because they eat insects. And birds eat insects, and that changes the amount and kinds of birds that are there, and then the amount and kinds of birds that are there change the way that seeds move around, can end up impacting how, you know, forest structure turns out. And that's just from one crayfish that looks exactly like another crayfish. So these things all are interconnected. And I was writing about William Ripple, I want to say his name is, at Oregon State University, recently published a paper evaluating all the body masses of all the creatures listed on the IUCN Red List. And he found that all of the largest animals are most at threat of extinction, but also all of the smallest animals. And we have a pretty good idea of what elephants and rhinos and manatees do to an ecosystem. We have almost no idea what all the little guys do and what would happen if they all disappear. And they are disproportionately looking to disappear. So the word that he used is, I think we need to be humble about these creatures and, you know, the impact that they could have on us. Because let's face it, a lot of these stories come back to how it matters to us and how it matters to normal people. We really don't know, and in many ways, you know, there's a lot to indicate that it could be a lot more impactful to the average person than, you know, any of us really realizes.
Yeah. Yeah, if anyone went to the party last night and got mosquito bites, you can blame the lack of bats from dying off from white nose syndrome. I was at a really great conference a couple of years ago. It was a scientific conference, and a bunch of journalists were there, and they had the opportunity in an audience setting for the scientists to pitch their research to the journalists. And one scientist had this great pitch about a snake. And one of the editors said, oh, we did a snake story a few years ago. Readers hated it. I'll never do another snake story again. How do you break through that barrier, that indifference through with journalists and editors and potentially with readers?
Well, one of my favorite examples was this series that Wired was doing, and maybe they're still doing it, but they had this absurd creature of the week. And so, you know, a lot of those were invertebrates, and they would tell these amazing stories and about these amazing creatures. And it was obviously, you know, in a very joking, informal style. And, you know, trying to get somebody interested in a, you know, tarantula wasp or something like that, is maybe not very easy, but by using, you know, humor and really presenting it for what it is, which is this weird creature, it got a lot of attention and was very readable. You know, again, not to keep going back to freshwater mussels, but I think it's one of the hardest things to write about. But, you know, there's always an angle. There's the fact that freshwater mussels sequester pharmaceuticals and heavy metals, the fact that they live for hundreds of years, the fact that we have more of them in this country than anywhere else in the world. So it's often not hard to find something interesting about these creatures. It's just, again, pivoting it to how does that affect humans and what is the human interest story. But there pretty much, you know, always is one.
I've tried everything over the last decade to get people to write about invertebrates. And even going so far, I'm from Kentucky, and we were trying to save these freshwater mussels in Paducah, and I tried. They're an indicator species. They have fascinating lives. They protect water quality, and I wasn't getting anywhere. And finally, this little Paducah paper, I was like, because God created them individually. And then the reporter was like, yeah, okay, now I get it. So I just keep going through the whole list until I get to something that resonates with whoever I'm talking to. And I found that most people respond well to animals as indicator species, amphibians as reflective of the health of the watersheds, insects as reflective of the health of the agricultural fields, and that how well they're doing eventually is going to impact how well we're doing.
Yeah, there's so many tricks. I mean, you do just sort of have to go through, you know, what applies to this story, what applies to this animal today. I wrote a story about stickleback fish, another little fish that you've never heard of in California. And they're endangered and, you know, that doesn't look good for them. Really interesting thing about sticklebacks is they that very specific subspecies has armor. And all these different sticklebacks will gain or lose their armor, their scales, depending on how many predators are around. And they do it really quickly in evolutionary time. So scientists think, hey, there might be something in here for us, you know, as far as evolution, as far as, you know, adaptability. And, you know, we'll never find it if they all go extinct. And so that's one way, you know, the way to tie it back to us, to science. But the devil's hole pupfish is probably not going to cure cancer, and it's not going to help us adapt to climate change. You know, some of these species really are just, we have to talk about the inherent, you know, value in keeping biodiversity because of the great unknown of what happens if biodiversity goes away. What happens if the little and the big are gone and we just have all these medium-sized animals? It not only is it boring, but, you know, there's probably more to it than we really realize at this point. But then I do think Matt Simon is the one that writes the Wired blog. He has a book, actually, that's The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, I think it is. And it sort of does another take on the weird animal of the week. And he does a great job of making these things accessible and fun and funny. And I definitely try to do that with my own writing. I know it's very unpopular sometimes to do popular culture references because they're very, you know, a couple years from now it might not make any sense. But right now, while this snail is still alive, it might actually matter to compare it to Lady Gaga in some way. And I don't know what that is, but I'll bet you there's a way. So playing into what's popular, even with young people, to get people, you know, on Twitter or Tumblr or any of these new media things, is maybe worth your while as well.
Yeah, and scientists do that from time to time, naming their new species after pop culture figures. I wrote about a plant last year that was named after Jimi Hendrix and found in an area that was important to Jimi Hendrix. It's kind of cool.
David Bowie spider.
David Bowie spider.
Beyonce
yep.
has one.
Yeah. Actually, there's a bunch of Beyonce creatures. Yeah.
She's huge Queen in the animal world.
I don't think anything's been named after Trump yet. Okay, so a lot of these creatures are threatened by habitat loss, climate change, whatever the case might be. Obviously, another problem is funding. There was a study out of Australia a year or so ago that looked at the charismatic megafauna versus what they called the ugly creatures. And the ugly creatures got virtually no conservation funding. And that's pretty much true wherever you look. So maybe we can have our panelists talk about where the gaps are, either in funding or other efforts that need to be addressed.
Sure. I think one of the bigger gaps that we've had in working with species is assessment and historical data. Again, with freshwater mussels, there isn't a great historical record in some areas of the country, in the Pacific Northwest, and with western mussels, very little is known about them historically. And so we've had the opportunity to work with the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Reservation and with some other partners to conduct better surveys and to get better information. But I think a conservation gap for us is often just knowing what's there and how it's changing. To go back to what you're saying about funding, there's almost no funding for freshwater mussels. One way that we've found to fill in the gaps is through citizen science data. And we've had a lot of success with this. Thank God everybody has this little computer in their pocket all the time now and are constantly taking pictures. And we've been able to use citizen science data through a project called Bumblebee Watch. That data was used to get the rusty patch bumblebee listed through the Western Monarch Thanksgiving count, which we've been a part of for over 20 years. We now have the data we need to offer a proper assessment of the Western Monarch population. And through that data and through other collection efforts, we've been able to determine that the Western population of monarch butterflies has actually declined 90% since the 1980s. We started these counts about around that time. So I would say for us, building the data, building the record to make the case is a hurdle, but we've been able to overcome that even without funding by harnessing citizen science and partnerships.
So freshwater mussels are the most endangered group of organisms in the United States. 40 of them have already gone extinct. 2/3 of the ones that still survive are threatened with extinction. A lot of them are protected under the Endangered Species Act, and once a species is protected, it gets a recovery plan and recovery funding. The endangered freshwater mussels get less than $100 a year each for their recovery. So even after they're listed, the service isn't doing anything for them.
And not each individual, each species.
Each species, yeah. And so a big challenge is the way they reproduce is they have to get a fish to swim up to them, and then they jump up and latch onto the fish's face, and they shoot their fertilized glaucidia into the fish's gills, and they each have a specific fish that they have to get to swim up to it. And so the species that scientists haven't known who the fish is, or in one case it's a salamander, just haven't been able to reproduce. And so scientists figured out how to go get the females, take their glaucidia, grow them in the lab on a medium, and then put the baby mussels back into the rivers. We can save them. Like, now that we have this technology, we can save all of them. It's incredibly expensive. Fish and Wildlife Service isn't going to spend the money on it, and they're going to go extinct even though we have the science that we need now to save them. So funding's very frustrating.
So my take on that, there are just billions of varieties of these species out there. There's so many stories out there, but it takes some effort to find them. Where can journalists go to start to find stories that they can tell, either on an international basis, a national basis, or in their local communities?
I think we've really been fortunate as an organization because often we're the only conservation group out there working on these species. So we have a really great rapport with a lot of journalists who come to us directly. And we do issue press releases. We regularly contribute to our blog and social media. So we've been really fortunate that we've become a source of information. So anytime you want to talk about bugs, give us a call.
Yeah, same here. And you think we're weird, you should meet the scientist in the laboratory trying to get the glaucidia out of the mussels, and I can put you in touch with them. 40 years extracting mussel glaucidia.
I would recommend getting on all these lists. You know, these guys are putting out press releases. Get on lists for all these sorts of organizations. There's the Turtle Survival Alliance. I just went to an event at a brewery last week with those guys, and they brought some turtles and showed everyone, and they're doing work to save, you know, freshwater turtles that don't get a ton of coverage. The other thing I would recommend is being on Twitter and following lots of scientists, even if they aren't, like, popular scientists or they don't have a lot of followers or they don't even tweet very much. You will find a scientist for everything on Twitter, and I follow so many of them just for that one tweet that I might happen to see that be like, huh, I didn't know that, and that turns into a story. But the other great thing about Twitter is you can throw questions out there. I'd say at least twice a month I throw out a question about, does anybody know anything about mussels? And then five people will get back to me and say, like, oh, if it's not them, they'll send you to somebody else because the scientists know each other. So Twitter is an amazing network that I just really can't recommend enough as far as putting you in touch with the right people, people that are actually working with these species.
Yeah, there's just a story about this little girl who loved bugs who got bullied at her school for loving bugs, and her mom tweeted to get help with to try to find a scientist and did the hashtag bugs are for girls, and there was a major news story about her, and she feels really validated and is now going to grow up and be an entomologist. And
yeah.
There's a Twitter.
Cool.
Start there. Morgan Jackson is the scientist that saw that tweet and threw it out to the world, and now it's been everywhere.
Cool. Good morning, America.
Yeah.
I also recommend scientific journals. There are a lot of journals out there besides Nature and Science, which are the ones that I think too many people pay attention to because they're the big ones. You can find a journal on just about anything. There's journals on insects, on ruminants, on mammals, on reptiles, on everything under the sun. Sign up for their email alerts. Sign up for their RSS alerts. You'll get papers coming your way that other people are not looking at. And that's how I always found a lot of stuff that no one else covered. And that's an important thing as a journalist, to show that you're telling unique stories. So at this point, I'd like to open it up to audience questions. Standard rules apply. SEJ members first. Identify yourself and your institution, and we'll repeat the question. I saw Colin's hand shoot up first.
Quick comment and then a question. Comment is, there is a species named after Donald Trump.
Uh-oh.
The I Freaking Love Science headline is blonde-haired moth with small genitals named after Donald Trump.
Right.
Yes.
This is something that I'm an editor at Hackett Magazine, and we do write a lot of stories about animals and ecosystems and stuff. But one of the things that I struggle with is you get a lot of pitches from people where they're like, there's this species, it's going extinct because of climate change. It's really important, and you get that email 10 times a week. There's a thing where the host of 99% Invisible, I'm just going to ramble for a minute, I went and saw a live taping of 99% Invisible, and someone stood up in the audience and said, how do I get someone to care about my important thing? It's really important. And he's like, important is one of the least useful forms of interesting. So I guess my question is, and it always comes back to this with endangered species, like, where's the utility aspect, where's the value, what's the purpose of saving it? And I just wonder if there's always focusing on important things, like, it's important. Is that, have you ever found that to be as effective as starting with just, this is weird and interesting, and then kind of backing into the important?
Yeah, the question is, when we're writing about these things, should we start with, this is important, or should we start with, hey, this is weird or wild, and then tell why it's important? What's the storytelling mechanism? Do we always have to be, hey, this is what's valuable about this species?
Well, I think you hit on a common frustration that at least we have around Xerces is that very thing, which is a lot of the creatures that we really care about, you know, don't have a huge impact or direct impact on humans. And, you know, like, we get really excited about things like the Siuslaw hairy-necked tiger beetle, which rolls off the tongue. But it's this, you know, it's a creature that is like, it's kind of ugly, but it's kind of beautiful, and it lives, you know, in these very narrow sandy bands in the Pacific Northwest. But it's one of the fastest creatures on Earth. If you scaled it up, it would be many orders of magnitude faster than a cheetah. And so even though this thing lives in this remote location and it's not terribly, quote-unquote, important, it's super interesting. And there are dozens and dozens of stories like that. And at least for our readership and our following, and I know that they're self-selecting bug nerds, but they find that information a lot more interesting and palatable than just constantly the hammering about this is going extinct, this is going extinct, this is going extinct. So, you know, oftentimes there isn't a practical hands-on thing that you can tell folks, you know, as to how they can save a species, but anytime there is, we try to work that in and try to give concrete examples of what people can do to make impacts on their world. A lot of times, indirectly, if you just work on the habitat, if you just protect the habitat, you can protect, you know, the species. And there are a number of things that everyone can be doing to improve their habitat, whatever, wherever it may be.
So the spring snails I'm trying to save from the Las Vegas water pipeline are differentiated by their penises. And they're named after their penises. There's the bifid duct perg and the longitudinal gland perg, and they're forked and ornamented and crazy. And this is Vegas, right? So you think you'd be able to sell somebody a story about these endangered species and their penises. No, I even pitched it to Playboy. I spent so much time. I was like, I'm going to get somebody to cover these Las Vegas snails and their penises because it's interesting. And it didn't get anywhere. But if I say they're part of the food web and important to water quality, then the mainstream media will bite on that.
Because that's the opposite of what I was saying.
Yeah.
I definitely focus on trying to find something interesting to geek out about. Because I think even the stories that I do that are not straight conservation stories, I always look at my job as sort of animal PR. Because, I mean, we have a lot of preconceived notions about animals. We don't like bugs. We don't like things that can sting us. We don't like things that are scary. We don't like things that we think are dirty. Cockroaches. I wrote like 1,500 words on cockroaches and how much I love cockroaches. Not because I have them in my house and I think they're great to live with, but because I read this book about the amazing biodiversity of cockroaches. And the cockroaches that we think of whenever we think of cockroaches represent like half of 1% of all cockroach biodiversity. There are hundreds of species of cockroaches, and they do everything. Some look like lightning bugs. Some look like ladybugs. Some live with ants. There are just so many ways to talk about cockroaches. So even the stories that I'm not doing, why we should save the cockroaches, I am trying to break down the wall of just hating a species because it's, a creepy crawly. And I think there's a lot that we can do more of to get people to interact with animals in a way that is not so standoffish a lot of times.
I think the answer also is that sometimes the story is about this rare species, but it's also about the person or people that are trying to save them. They're the characters. The animals can't talk. They're not, I did a great story last year about a scientist who received a box in the mail, unsolicited, and inside was a plant he thought was extinct. And that started off a round of discovery. This plant is not that interesting, but the fact that it lives in a 10-square-foot range, and everyone thought it was gone for decades, and it showed up in his mailbox, that was the story. And I found that little teeny tiny detail buried in the scientific paper. So read those papers thoroughly and see what comes up. Next question. Michael.
Michael Conis from the Center for Environmental Journalism, and in talking with some of the folks in D.C. covering the Pruitt administration, Pruitt's position in the current administration, there's a sense that a lot of what's very worrying to many of us probably won't happen because they'll get hung up in the courts. Is there a sense that some of the threats, particularly Endangered Species Act listings, that there are options in the courts or in the bureaucracy to prevent some of the rollbacks that some of the scientists I've been talking to are very concerned about?
So how can the courts serve as a mechanism to lessen the impact of the Trump, Pruitt, et cetera, administration?
I think you can probably speak to that.
We've already filed like 3 dozen lawsuits against the Trump administration. I read FOIAs now instead of scientific journals, and it's going to take years in court to undo the rollbacks that they're doing. And it's just not a good moment in history to have to fight over policy in the middle of an extinction crisis and climate change. It's the worst possible time to spend your time fighting for policy instead of real change. But yeah, we're in court. Lots of people are in court. Even Dan Ash, the former director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, he was interviewed in Bloomberg this week because Trump secretly pulled critical habitats for 45 species. And Dan Ash was like, that was a really dumb thing to do. You're going to lose in court.
But meanwhile. What was it, 37 species that got denied the other day or 25? Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were snails. Mm-hmm. It's going to take years of process to try to start that all over again.
Yeah.
So some stuff might get hung up in court. Other stuff, that opportunity has just been lost. Yes, in back.
Eric Friedman, I'm the director of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism at Michigan State. I just want to second what John said about the importance of finding obscure studies. I use wetland science, our students focus on Great Lakes coverage, and I go through every week or every 2 weeks, and I have my couple of search terms, and I'm always getting stuff. Some of it's incomprehensible to me. And some of it is, like I use Great Lakes, well, sometimes Great Lakes of East Africa show up. but these are journals that, and they're not the ones you talked about or the medical field, JAMA, Lancet, they have a PR outfit. But the thing I'd add is there's a proliferation of predatory journals and predatory conferences, and predatory meaning they're designed primarily to raise money, earn money and profits for the owners while diluting young, predominantly young scholars that this work is actually going to be read and cited. Some of the work is fine, but it's basically pay to play. And you can get through the peer review process and be online in a week or two, which in the real world doesn't happen. So if it's an unfamiliar journal to me, I search predatory and the title of that journal, and then I also look, there's some publishing companies, one is Nova, one is David Publishing, and if I see that in the web address or the email address, or if Mike probably gets the same thing in other academics, you get these invitations to attend conferences or to submit manuscripts, and the deadline's in 2 days and it'll be published in 2 weeks. But if it's not written with subjects and predicates and capital letters and periods, that to me is a sign as well. So just because you get something in the mail, an alert, press release, that purports to be from a valid sounding journal, you should do a couple of minutes worth of due diligence on Google search and see if it's true. And I also look at the board of editors, because if they're all from obscure universities in Northern Bangladesh, I become even more suspicious about the credibility, because our credibility becomes that of the journal we've drawn this from.
Yeah, so avoid predatory journals, and you can tell, I mean, there are a lot of small, unexpected journals from big publishers like Wiley. So start with some of those places first, and if you're not sure about if this small journal is worth it, look at the authors. They're almost undoubtedly have a Google Scholar page. Look at their university page. Look at the impact factor of the journal. See if other journals are citing this journal. You can make decisions based on that, but also start with the paper.
I would also say that, this is when it really helps to have a Rolodex, not an actual Rolodex, because no one has those, but like when you have a group of people that you can trust to run things by. And so a lot of scientists, I have them friendly with it, I'll shoot something their way and say, is this total bunk or what? Because a lot of times these things don't get picked up, and it's because they're bunk. I wrote about a story about dung beetles a while back, that there was a paper in a medical journal that said that they had found scarabs living, like crawling inside of children's anuses in the streets of India. I sort of very much wanted this to be true because it sounded like it would be a viral story that I had plucked out of nowhere. But the more beetle talk people I talked to just said, no way, here's why it won't work for all these different reasons. So then I wrote a story about, you know, how this isn't true, but there's this story on the internet, you know, saying that, you know, this is possible. And that's an interesting way to begin talking about dung beetles and how crazy cool dung beetles are. So you can use it as an opportunity. But I will say, too, there was another story that did get a lot of press about dolphins in Russia having a conversation, the first conversation recorded between dolphins. And I got assigned the story, and the more people I talked to, I've never heard scientists so mad about a story. And, like, literally saying things to me like, this story is total fucking bullshit, and you can quote me on that. Like, really, really mad people. And so we published basically a takedown for Nat Geo News, and it was one of the few stories out there that actually took this story to task. Everyone else sort of just reported it as, hey, dolphins are having conversations, and now we can hear them, and, you know, it's the future. But you definitely have to run these things by other scientists, and that's what's going to make your story better anyway. So that's just, you know, basics, but definitely don't trust anything at its word.
My name is Leighton Registrar. I'm a writer from Lexington, Kentucky. So if the Fish and Wildlife is dedicating too much money and resources to gain fishing animals, should there be a different agency enforcing the Endangered Species Act?
If Fish and Wildlife Service is directing too much money toward game animals, should a different agency be in charge of the Endangered Species Act?
I'll take that. So there's different pots of money at Fish and Wildlife Service. Even within the Endangered Species Act, there's money for listing, there's money for recovery, there's money for non-game fishes. So it comes out of a different account. It's a different line item. What needs to happen is there needs to be more money in the recovery budget. And Fish and Wildlife Service asks Congress for an amount of money, and Congress generally grants it, probably not the next 3 years, but they don't ask for enough money. And they're supposed to estimate in the recovery plans how much money they need to save a species, and of course that changes. But we put out a report, and I can't tell you off the top of my head, we figured out how much money it would take to fully implement all these recovery plans and save these species. So instead of a different agency, there just needs to be more recovery money.
And I would add that a lot of state agencies are more focused on game agencies or game species, and I think that there's a gap on the state level that's going to be a big issue over the coming years, especially as revenue from hunting continues to decline. Yes?
Jeff Giller, freelancer. I sometimes hear people talking about and sometimes encourage sort of scientists to sort of reach out to journalists if they think they have something that, you know, they should get coverage. In my personal experience, sometimes scientists don't have such a good sense of what, you know, they're doing, whether or not that's actually going to make for a good sort of news story. And how much do you guys think that that's useful to sort of cultivate that kind of relationship? Like, hey, like, if you have something cool, send it my way. Or is it, you know, is there just going to be so much stuff that is not going to be really worth covering that it's not really worth having that conversation?
How many relationships with scientists should you cultivate to have them send you stuff when it's published, when it's available, saying, hey, this is cool, or will it not be worth it, or will you just get too much than you can handle? All valid questions.
I would just say, you know, if you had an area of interest surrounding invertebrates, I think one of the reasons that so many journalists contact our agency is that more than, you know, two-thirds of our staff are scientists. So it's kind of a one-stop shop, and the information that you're going to get from us is fact-based and science-based. But also, most of our staff do publish, and they publish journal articles, and we publish those, we put those out there, we put out press releases. So it could be more passive. It could just be having an organization like us as part of your contact list, and if you have an interest in a subject area, reaching out. Or following kind of our press release and our information that we're putting out there.
As a scientist who cold calls reporters, I never know what's going to happen. The first time I called AP Atlanta, they told me they didn't cover the environment. So you never know what's going to happen. And I try to give them, I know that journalists are super busy, so I try to give my best 5-second pitch, and then I say, okay, thanks. Call me if you change your mind.
I recommend doing exactly that. You know, if I cover something from someone that I really like, I will definitely say, like, hey, feel free, reach out next time you have something you want to share. Doesn't even necessarily have to be a published paper, because I'm going to take it and I'm going to run it by other people. So it's not like they're, you know, just giving me their talking points. But it's a great way to get new leads, and, you know, keeping relationships with these people a lot of times just leads you to a better knowledge base. And, you know, again, following people on Twitter, you might not write about, you know, 1/10 of the things you see on there, but I've learned so much from all these people on Twitter that whenever that story does come back to me, I have a good basis of knowledge just because I'm literally listening to scientists talk all day long. So I say go for it.
I personally get more press releases and personal communications than I can handle. Because I've been doing this for 10, 11 years, and they know me, and they know they've covered my stuff. And often there are times where it's just more than I can potentially cover. And I'll just have to tell people, I can't cover this one this time around. But what's also good is if you have other journalists in your back pocket, you can say, hey, maybe this other journalist can cover this. There's a lot of goodwill that builds by establishing connections, scientist to scientist, to journalist to journalist to journalist, and it's never a bad thing. Yes.
Question for you. When you've identified a species that's in danger, how do you go about convincing people nearby that it needs protection, especially when it might bump up against, you know, livelihoods, how they make money?
How do you convince people who live near an endangered species to take it seriously, to conserve it when it might bump up against their natural interests, their economic interests, their lifestyle? whether or not they can build on their property, certain things like that.
I think that's always going to be a challenge. You know, one interesting spin that I saw a journalist take about the American burying beetle, which is a beetle that's listed as endangered and is spread throughout the Midwest and the Northeast, and it's suffered massive declines. Other than the fact that it's just interesting in and of itself, a piece I read that I enjoyed about it was these people who were going out hunting for it and hunting for it like treasure. And these farmers that actually had it on their property, and rather than seeing it as a burden that was keeping them from developing their property, they saw it as this gold mine where they have this unique, really special thing that they basically were responsible for stewarding and responsible for protecting. So, I mean, you're always going to have conflicting interests. You're going to have, developers that are hindered by this. And you're going to have environmentalists who, you know, are crazy on board with protecting species. So you're not going to be able to please all people, but I think that there's often interesting ways of changing the viewpoint.
And I would say the Endangered Species Act isn't as rigid as most people think it is. There's so many mechanisms that the service has in place, 4D rules, habitat conservation plans, safe harbor agreements, so that the species can get not as much as we think it may need, but so that it can survive and so that people can go about what they're doing. Like, there was a big survey of jeopardy biological opinions. The Endangered Species Act says the federal government can't jeopardize a species, so they have to do a document called a biological opinion to assure that federally funded or permitted projects don't cause jeopardy. And 99% of projects are non-jeopardy determinations. So when you get into jobs versus the environment or endangered species versus development, the law isn't as rigid as it's portrayed to be, the way it actually plays out.
But are people generally receptive to that sort of message?
No. And even with the monarch butterfly, which is so beloved, there are monarch scientists who think it should be protected, and there are monarch scientists who, quote, think there'll be a shoot, shovel, and shut up approach, that farmers will plow under their milkweed instead of supporting monarchs on their property. So, yeah.
Okay. And just one other question. I actually live in Atlanta.
Okay. Do you cover the environment?
give me a call next time.
Okay.
That wasn't about the Three Ridge Mussels downriver from Atlanta, was it?
It was about 10 years ago we filed a petition to protect 400 freshwater species in the Southeast.
Okay.
So I was cold calling reporters. Yeah.
Christine?
Yes, related to that, a lot of times these rare species become fodder for the right wing, you know, the snail darter, the delta smelt, the spotted owl, and they become the dog whistle for hating government. You know, what can we do about this?
What can we do about the right wing media machine turning these species into villains?
Tell them God created them individually.
Yeah.
And Jesus said he knows when every sparrow falls out of the sky.
And, yeah. And you can quote her on that.
You can. And then, I mean, there's great organizations out there. Christians for the Mountains is one. They're a Christian group in West Virginia that fights mountaintop removal coal mining. They're trying to bridge the gap between evangelicals and people trying to save the environment. And yeah, I just try to meet people wherever they are. If it starts with, I have a lab, do you have a lab? You know, wherever they are, and go from there.
There's a really interesting, and this isn't really an answer, but more just amusing, but like there's an interesting common ground between people on the like middle right and middle left, not far right and far left, but you know, a lot of the people that are in the woods every day that know animals way more than a lot of scientists are hunters and fishermen and people that just like to take hikes and, you know, around their property. And, you know, for as much as a lot of people maybe look down on fishing and hunting, you know, there's a ton of money that comes for conservation because of hunting and fishing. And groups like Duck Unlimited and Pheasants Forever and, you know, some of these groups, they have really done serious conservation work. Maybe not the way that, you know, scientists would want it to be done, but it's definitely not nothing. And so I think I've written stories about the National Wild Turkey Federation and, you know, the way that they basically brought turkeys back from, almost, you know, near extinction in North America. And now there are actually turkeys in, like, 20 states that they never were in before, which is arguably maybe not the best thing, but it's probably better than, you know, them being extinct. So there are these groups that I think reach out to that other side, and, you know, those members have a conservation ethic, even if it's different than the conservation ethic on the left. So I think it's important to tap into those organizations and the knowledge that they have, but also the members, and because that's definitely an avenue into, you know, crossing the aisle, as we would say.
And sometimes there's uncommon alliances, like the ranchers in Nevada want to protect these springs and thus these spring snails, because if Vegas gets to suck up all that water, their ranches are going to go under. So we can unite around saving those springs.
I think one of the things that we struggle with as well is just building general science literacy. And I think, you know, in a lot of the work that we do, for example, the conversation begins and ends with honeybees when we talk about pollinators. And so I think, you know, expanding beyond that and just, you know, getting the right information out there and trying to push scientific literacy in general, it would be helpful, would help start to bridge the gap.
Every weird animal story is a chance to do animal PR. And, you know, even if it doesn't have a conservation bent, it might do some good. You know, I grew up with people that thought the only good snake was a dead snake. And, you know, the more we can change those sorts of attitudes, the better in the long run.
Yeah. There's also the value of long-term science that might be the long tail of a story. One of my favorite things I just wrote about, there was 10, 20 years ago, there was a researcher in Oregon who's visited the coast and saw all these mussels sticking together, just grabbing onto each other. And that led to him to look at soybeans and how they're proteins. And that led to the discovery of a new glue to make plywood to replace formaldehyde, which was making everyone sick. And a couple weeks ago, that earned a Golden Goose Award, which is the opposite of the Golden Fleece Award, where, you know, they were made fun of projects that got funded by federal science. The Golden Goose Award recognizes projects that show the value of federal funded research. I mean, granted, it took a long time, but also this year, the people who identified the chytrid virus that's killing frogs all around the world, they were among the recipients of that award. So that shows the value of some of this study, whether it may maybe not show the value of a specific species, but shows the value of why we should be looking at some of these ugly little critters and conserving them, because we might learn something that'll benefit all of us.
John Webb, I'm the advisory counsel to the Presidential Task Force on Wildlife Trafficking. And I've been a prosecutor for 25 years in the Department of Justice doing wildlife cases. One of the things that you have available to you is a monthly report prepared by the Environmental Crime Section of all the cases that are currently being prosecuted by the U.S. Department of Justice. And it's available on the DOJ website. And some of those cases are things like scarabs, orchids, all kinds of the fauna that you don't associate with the megafauna and flora. And so you can get a head start, if you will, by going to that website and to that monthly report, see what the Department of Justice is working.
So check out the Department of Justice monthly report on Environmental Crime Section monthly report. Yeah.
It's about 15, 20 pages long, and it has all the cases. For instance, one of the cases that was recently prosecuted was the ability of the U.S. government to prosecute somebody, lumber liquidators, who brought into the United States wood poached from oak trees in Siberia. I mean, suddenly now, all of a sudden, our U.S. law literally is reaching halfway around the globe protecting oak forests where the Siberian tiger is roaming. I mean, that's a story that really hasn't gotten a whole lot of coverage.
Yeah.
And just one final word. I work in the Department of Justice when President Reagan was the president, and we survived that. You just have to take a deep breath sometimes. The statutes and the people that enforce them and the institutions that are all involved in this work are pretty strong, and there may be some glitches in the road, there may be some bumps, but I will assure you when the year 2020 comes around, there will be an Endangered Species Act, a LACI Act, and Marine Mammal Protection Act, and it'll still have the basic core function.
Fantastic. And just wildlife crime, illegal lumber, all these things, the huge amount of stories in there that are just slightly different variations on this stuff. Pangolin scales, traditional medicine, a lot of things. And I found ivory for sale in my local Oregon thrift shops and antique shops. I couldn't buy it to verify. You got to verify it's really ivory, but I didn't want to legally buy it and try and get in trouble. But you'll be amazed what you find poking around your own local community that might be a story. And that's Michael again.
How can we better cover some of the nuances with these species, and particularly communities getting involved sometimes in protection? So one of my students' stories years ago on pollinators, and particularly our honeybee, which is from outside of our country, and dealing with a bunch of native bees, and she had been heavily involved in the backyard beekeeping movement, and her story discovered that actually that's been really counterproductive towards protecting pollinators, at least wherever we live, where the, basically these bees are being kept in backyards, which are much closer than bees normally are in nature, and that allowed pathogens to move through native bee populations much faster than they would have, and yet we have this community throughout Boulder that is convinced that, being a backyard beekeeper. Can we cover the intricacies of these things a little bit better so that communities are better informed about this and cover things like that without being counterproductive towards protecting them overall?
How can we be more nuanced and productive in our stories to enable conservation, especially when it might be a little bit counterintuitive that protecting your local native pollinators is more important than bringing in non-native bees for your backyard hives?
Yeah, nuance is hard. not to pitch a headline to you, but for that particular story, saying that backyard bees are not good for bees is definitely going to get people's attention. And I think that's one of our biggest things that we as an organization would like to see happen is just getting right on the science and telling the stories often enough and in small enough bites to really get the right message out there. One of my favorite programs in the organization deals with pesticides, and that's just, it's a morass of a topic because you have, political interests and people on the left and people on the right, and the science is hard, and the science is very nuanced, and we have the head of that program, Amay Code, is fantastic at breaking it down and really giving as close as she can to sound bites to explain very thorny and very complex situations.
I just say you have to try, plant milkweed is going to be the takeaway from a story, but the fine line is plant milkweed that hasn't been treated with neonicotinoids, that's native to your area, and then cut it back in the fall so it doesn't propagate spores. But most readers are just going to go away with the plant milkweed, so you just have to try.
Yeah, so you almost have to break those down, though, into separate stories. So
Or an actual checklist.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you also have to fight fatigue. There are so many stories about what we're doing wrong that and there's so much science that's come out about politically telling people that they're doing it wrong is not helping. It's not convincing anybody. So I think you do have to sort of lead people by the hand a little bit and say we recognize that a lot of people want to help bees. Here's the how do we best help them? Because there are a lot of these stories where, people think that they're killing an invasive species, but they're actually killing a native species, or they think that they're saving a tortoise off the road by putting it in the ocean, but tortoises don't live in the ocean. And, the more education we can do gently, I think, is probably the most effective way to, get people to do the right thing. But you're right, the nuance of the milkweed even is a very, kind of a difficult story to write.
Yeah. And you mentioned exhaustion. I mean, I'm a real proponent of if you write three really negative stories, write a positive one. It doesn't have to be three to one, but balance it out. Tell people that certain things are working and let them sink it in.
So for John and Jason, how often do you try to have a solutions lens or a solutions portion of your story to mitigate sometimes the negative?
I mean, I would say not every story I write even has options for an average person to do beyond the obvious, donate to the organizations that are, working on this best. But if there is a solution, I usually try to put it in every article. And it's rare that I get to the end of a story and just throw up my hands and say, well, you know, this animal's screwed, because there's always something that can be done, whether or not it actually will be done. But I think that's something you have to grapple with a little bit on this beat, because if everybody cared equally about every animal that I wrote about, there would be but nothing would get done, because, you know, obviously things have to be prioritized. But that's also not my job. My job is to bring this to light and then move on to the next story, because I can't just write about the Rusty Patch Bumblebee every week. So, you know, we're part of a machine, and you have to play your role a little bit, and then, you know, let the people take it from there, I think.
Anything else? I'd like to finish by asking the panel, we already heard from Justin a little bit on this, but name one of your favorite unknown species or groups of species that you think people deserves a little bit more attention.
I mean, if I could get people to pay attention to any of the animals we work on, it would have to be freshwater mussels, because they're just so important. And it's been described that the United States is like the Amazon in terms of biodiversity when it comes to freshwater mussels. And it's these things that are just so not charismatic, but so deeply important. And the time scale for regenerating them once they start declining is so long that it's really something that I wish there was more attention on, and that we worked more on.
Yeah, the orangefoot pimpleback pearly mussel is kind of your penultimate garbage pail kid species. There's two surviving populations. It's going to go extinct if we don't get the money to go kidnap them, take their glaucidae in a lab, and put them back. I kind of want to do a GoFundMe for it. Because it's so expensive, because divers have to go find them, and that's very expensive. But yeah, the orangefoot pimpleback pearly mussel.
Mine's a little more broad. I honestly like to focus on North American animals, because now that we have the internet and we have BuzzFeed and we have all these things, people know more about honey badgers and these exotic species from elsewhere, penguins. Think about how much people know about penguins. You've never been to Antarctica, but you know about what they eat, where they live, how they mate, how they raise their young. You know all these things about penguins, and why? Because they're adorable, and there have been like 10,000 nature documentaries about penguins. How much do you know about the lifespan or the life cycle of an opossum? You probably pass one dead on the road like 3 times a day, but you don't know anything about them. So there's, a lot of different ways to look at this stuff, and one of the ways that I look at it is trying to teach people about North American animals that they might encounter in their own backyards, and that can be even something that they think they know about, like the lightning bug. And they don't know anything about, like, how there are predatory lightning bugs that, fake the signs of other lightning bugs, and then they come in and then they eat them and devour them and steal their poison. And there are these stories for everything. So I think really just finding your niche and your passion, and that will translate into good stories.
And on that note, I'd like to thank our audience and thank our distinguished panel for coming out to learn about everything beyond megafauna. Coming up in just about 5 minutes is the big plenary on the 6th mass extinction. I hear Jane Goodall is going to be video chatting into it. At least that was the word as of yesterday. Lunch is apparently already sitting on the tables. So thank you again, everyone, very much. And round of applause.